This is an Equity Mates Media podcast.
You're listening to Get Started Investing, a production of Equity Mates Media. This series is everything you need to get started on your investing journey.
You don't need a lot of brains in this business. Investing in yourself is the best thing you can do. Anything that improves your own
time. Now you can get rich very young just by having an idea.
I mean, I can buy anything I want, basically, but I can't buy time.
Welcome to another episode of Equity Mates, a podcast that follows our journey of investing. Whether you're an absolute beginner or approaching Warren Buffett status, our aim is to help break down your barriers from beginning to dividend. My name is Bryce, and as always, I'm joined by my equity buddy, Ren. How are you going?
I'm very good, Bryce. Very excited for this episode. We love this time of year in the lead up to the Sohn Hearts and Minds Conference because some of the best investors in Australia, but importantly, some of the best investors from around the world come to Australia and pitch one of their best ideas or their best idea, all for charity. And we're so lucky that we're joined by one of the speakers at this year's Sohn Hearts and Minds Conference.
It is our pleasure to welcome Ricky Sandler to Equity Mates. Ricky, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Ricky is the founder, chief investment officer, and chief executive officer of Eminence Capital. Ricky founded Eminence in 1999 and has grown it into a $5.7 billion asset manager. As Ren said, Ricky is speaking at the Hearts and Minds Conference on the 18th of November. And if you're unaware of what Hearts and Minds is, it is one of the leading finance conferences here in Australia dedicated to supporting Australian medical research.
Now, Ricky, we got a lot to unpack here, but we always love to start these interviews with experts by hearing the story of their first investment. We generally find there's a good story or a good lesson that comes out of it. So to kick us off today, can you take us back? What was your first investment?
So it's an interesting question. My family, my father was in the investment business. He was a Goldman Sachs research analyst and an early hedge fund manager, and started out in his own in 1982. So I guess I technically had some investments as a teenager, but I wasn't really all that engaged. And frankly, it wasn't until I wasn't exactly sure I was going to go into the investment business, and it wasn't until I actually did. Started managing like a paper portfolio at Mark Asset Management, where I first started, that I kind of really got the essence of kind of making investments, making mistakes, you know, things that like you picked on your own and kind of completely. So there's a couple, but I think maybe the one that was most interesting to me was a company called Felcor Lodging, and it was when REITs were just becoming popular in the early 90s. So this must have been like 1992 or three. They were a lodging REIT. I knew the lodging space pretty well, and it was a company that came public with six, they only owned six hotels. It was a pretty small company, but there was a really big opportunity to buy hotels and convert them to an Embassy Suites flag, which was sort of a better brand and improved kind of returns on capital. And it was sort of one of the first ones I brought to him on to my boss and sort of bought in my paper portfolio. There's so many investment stories over kind of having done this for 30 years. I'm not sure that, you know, any one is going to be some illuminating story other than like having, you know, always loving to discover things and loving kind of the intellectual and kind of a scrappy pursuit of gaining an edge in investing.
Mm. Now, we love that about investing as well. The rabbit holes that it forces you down, that if you weren't sort of in the game and passionate about it, you wouldn't find yourself going down. It's super exciting. So, Ricky, before founding Eminence, you worked at Mark Asset Management, which you mentioned, and you co-founded Fusion Capital Management. Really interested to understand, what have you learned over that period of time, and how was the market in the mid to late 1990s compared to today?
Yeah, sure. It's a great question, and there have definitely been some really important formative things that have come out of my experiences. You know, I think working for Morris Market, Mark Asset Management, he was a believer in deep research, in owning great companies, I've continued to take that to heart and thought that was terrific. I think, you know, he was probably less valuation sensitive than I am. And I think that you know, worked for him and you know, he's a terrific investor. And I think for me, you know, I've talked about finding your own investing compass. Like, I had a harder time squaring that. And so when we launched Fusion, quality and value were our two pillars of what we wanted to buy, kind of good businesses at cheap prices. And then, you know, I think in the Fusion years, we had a really good run. And then in 1998, the Russian debt crisis hit and the emerging markets crashed and there was kind of a growth scare. And I think we had not built a very deep shorting practice. I think we were probably spent 70% of our time on the long side and then would short sort of similar companies or some companies that we understood to be more expensive and maybe less well positioned than what we were long, but didn't build a single stock shorting practice. And I think the feeling when the market was really under pressure and I didn't have the protection that I needed to feel like I wanted to go on the offense was something that caused me when I launched Eminence to build single stock shorting into 50% of our time and build a core competency there and really make that part of our strength is to have staying power and even offensive power amidst dislocation. And that's been one of the recurring things about cycles is, you know, you ultimately need to go on the offense at some point in every crisis. And having that ability and conviction, not just conviction, the ability based on your portfolio. So single stock shorting was something that I really took away from the experience at Fusion that I wanted to do better and much more rigorously in Eminence. And that's been a core part of what we've built over the last 23 years in Eminence.
Yeah, just a follow on for retail investors who don't have the ability to short like institutions and like, you know, large fund managers like yourself, how should we think about, you know, protecting and the defensive side in moments like now?
Yeah, but this is a great question. And I think highlights an issue that shorting is hard and it requires diversification and scale and resources. And so I don't think it's easy for individual investors to do, and I wouldn't practice it. What I would say for individual investors is I think the key is, you know, trying not to get caught up or overextended as in sort of a emotional euphoric type events and try not to get overly depressed in really kind of tough times. I think that an individual investor, hopefully, if he's got discipline, can be building some cash when things are frothy and can be deploying that cash when they're less frothy or maybe very, very fearful. I think they can also use broad-based indexes to hedge parts of their portfolio at parts of the time if they're particularly worried. I don't think holding a 10, 20, 30% hedge against their portfolio and the S&P is taking a lot of risk and is probably protecting a lot. I'm not suggesting that they constantly do that, but I'm suggesting that's a tool. In addition to building up some cash, I think they can use things like that to cushion the downsides. And obviously, you know, don't have more allocated to equities than is appropriate for where they are in their life cycle. And money that they need in the next 12 months and never use leverage. I think is kind of some things I think individuals can do.
Yeah, great advice.
In preparing for this interview, I listened to your interview with Patrick O'Shaughnessy, and you spoke about how that period in the late 90s really gave rise to the hedge fund and the hedge funds excelled in that period. And then really up until 2008, they had like a real golden moment. And I guess, you know, that period started with a massive sell-off in high growth tech names and then hedge funds really emerged out of that. If we fast forward to 2022, we've sort of gone through a decade of active management really having to work to keep up with an S&P 500 and an index that just is flying and pushed up by these massive tech names. And then we've seen a massive sell-off in high growth tech. Do you think this is a setup similar to the late 90s where active management is going to really shine through?
I do. It depends on the type of active management. Obviously, if you're a growth manager and your formative years and your learnings came from, you know, the post-GFC period and 2015 to 2019, you learned one thing. You learned that valuation didn't matter and buy the best companies and the fastest growing companies. And, you know, I think some managers haven't done so well, but I think the true stock pickers that have kind of valuation discipline and short selling skills have and will continue to fare well both this year and going forward. And I think it'll be a much better environment, and I think a good environment for the right type of active management and stock picking. And so, you know, I think you need to have independence. You need to be not afraid to be alone and kind of wrong, because I think that the challenge in investing is people tend to not like to be kind of alone and independent and different. And in order to do that, it takes good research that you can lean on, and kind of, you know, holding your convictions. And I think that type of disciplined investor is going to do quite well in this market.
Mm. So, Ricky, focusing on your long positions, how would you define your investment philosophy? You mentioned quality and value, but if you were to drill down a bit on that, how do you define it?
What I like to say is simplistically, and then I'll kind of dive in. Simplistically, we want to buy ownable businesses that are mispriced stocks, where we understand why the stocks are mispriced, and we believe something over the next 2 to 3 years will change that mispricing. And let me drill into that a little bit for kind of sense. So ownable businesses, that means that it's a business which, if you paid a fair price, you'd be happy to own for your family for the next 5 to 10 years, because it's a business that will continue to be competitively in a good place, generate good cash flow, grow. You know, you're not worried about major structural challenges. You're not worried about some exogenous macro event like a commodity type business. So for us, it's businesses that have, you know, at least, you know, management teams that we trust, businesses that are in control of their own destiny, and businesses that over time should grow somewhere between moderately to very quickly. But the point of that, I think, is that when markets get really dislocated, you need a source of strong hand. And the ownable business point says, if all my investors left me, I'm left with this portfolio, I'm good. I feel good for me and my family and the employees here. And so it turns out to be markets get very volatile for different reasons at different points in time and very dislocated. And kind of leaning on that as an ultimate backstop is very important. But I think, you know, different than others, we want to make sure we buy mispriced securities. And I think a lot of other investors might like great businesses or fast growing businesses, or, you know, low multiple businesses. And I think that we say, I want to understand, I want to believe the stock is mispriced for what we believe it is, and understand what that source of mispricing is. Sometimes it's a little bit of a technical, a factor or a macro reason why other people are selling it, and you believe that will work its way out. Sometimes it's a short-term problem in a good company, but there's some misperception or some reason people are selling it. And then you, through your research and through your analysis, both understand you know, why that exists and believe that over a reasonable time horizon that will change. And so because it's an ownable business, it should be compounding value at a reasonable rate. And because it's mispriced, it should get revalued. And so over that 2 to 3 year period of time, we're hoping to make more like 50 to 100% in our stock, because we'll get a couple of years of compounded value and then maybe a 30 to 50% revaluation. And then if it is still a good company and it is fairly priced but not cheap, we'll probably move on and leave the compounding to somebody else and try to rotate that back into the next mispriced ownable business. And I think that you know, in a nutshell kind of encompasses us. And you know, as I said, I love the best business that's growing the fastest at a really low multiple, but they never all exist. And if it did exist and I couldn't figure out like what was mispriced about it, I might not even buy it because I might not understand what could change. Mm-hmm. And so we are in the business of buying mispriced securities, but amongst a subset of assets.
Yeah. I think that distinction between like undervalued and mispriced is really interesting. And I know in a previous interview, you explained with an example of a coffee company that that you invested in where it wasn't that, you know, that it was undervalued, it was that it was mispriced. And that I think really illustrated it. Can you share that example with us and so it can really illustrate it to the audience?
Sure. And I think that, you know, undervalued is an opinion. It trades here, I think it's worth, you know, 30% more. It's my opinion. I can give you a lot of finance theory. It should trade at this multiple, but you know, ultimately, you know, mispriced means that other investors are looking at it in a certain way, treating it in a certain way, and therefore pricing it in a certain way, which may be technically accurate today, but is not accurate over a normalized horizon. And that will change. So I think that's sort of the high level difference. And I think in Green Mountain's case, which you know Green Mountain owned Keurig, the coffee company that had they have the machines and the single serve pods, and it was a company that had a lot of different kind of messy things going on. We got involved. It had been a big growth stock that had come crashing down. And there were a few things that were mispriced about how investors thought about it. One of which was they were losing money in trying to get into international markets. And they were losing money trying to get into the cold business. And they were going to make a machine that could make a cold beverage, much like the hot coffee beverage that the Keurig machines make. And the market was valuing the company on its earnings. I think when we got invested, it was probably at a teens multiple of earnings. But if you took away the losses, it was probably trading at more like 10 times the core earnings. And we would say they could shut those businesses down. They're not capitalizing those losses at into the earnings. It's sort of saying those businesses have big negative value. And they might have some negative value, like they'll put some money into it before they make a decision or before it turns profit. But one, the market was not treating some of the money-losing businesses independently. And then I think the other issue was that the company originally had a patent on the pod, and they had invested a ton, and that was going away, and they'd invested a ton in manufacturing, so that if companies weren't paying them a royalty, they would be the supplier. They could do a lot for all the other brands. Starbucks would come into the systems, and Nestle, and all these other brands would come on, and I think people believed that the profit per cup would go down a lot, and through our analysis, we understood that was much more stable than people understood just looking at like the patents going away because of how they had invested in kind of the manufacturing scale. So they were the low cost producer of these, and so they could do this for you and make their profit per cup in a way that didn't necessarily rely on the royalty. So that's why the market priced it at a lower multiple than it should be. And so there was a lot of messy things going on at the time. We sometimes like, I wouldn't say messy situations implies that there are real issues, but messy financials where there's something obscuring what's really going on. And through both our analysis and our research, we kind of can get to the right place and therefore have a different view. I think particularly in today's environment where quants and other people who are sort of scraping and using data and stocks trading on factors, we find one today where, you know, if a company is losing money, it is now in this unprofitable basket. And many of those companies will never be profitable, but quite a few are unprofitable today, but for good reason. And so there are things that in we often find when the financials look one way, but we can understand the underlying health in a different way, so we know that will change. That could create an opportunity about why something's mispriced and what will change about it.
Mm. So, Ricky, let's turn to Growing Eminence, founded in 1999. And as we said at the top, it's now a $5.7 billion business. But we're interested to know how you think about the balance of being a great investor and then also building a great investment house. How do you think about that process?
I mean, it's a wonderful question, because I think that they're very different skill sets, and oftentimes don't necessarily find themselves in the same person. I think being a great investor, you know, a lot of the things we've talked about, deep research, different point of view, and be willing to kind of be different than others and contrarian in some ways. Not contrarian for contrarian's sake, but making sure you have a point of difference. I'm famous for saying, you know, if I have a macro view or some other view, it's not valuable if it's consensus. It's kind of priced in. So there's some elements about that. I think in growing a business, investing is a very lonely, kind of insular, kind of inner confidence. And you grow a business, you're attracting talent, you're nurturing talent, you're attracting investors. You have to have a little bit of EQ and other things to sort of do that. And you know, there are things that I've had to learn along the way. I don't, you know, I'm a better version of my younger self, having been through different iterations and having started a small firm and ultimately growing it and doing things, you know, to kind of building around your weaknesses as a human, as an investor is a very important part of this business. And I think maybe the last piece is like building a good culture, which, you know, is a kind of tagline, but I think we take it to heart. And I think you want to create an environment where the employees want to come in and do battle together. They like the people, they respect the people around them. Their biggest motivation for working hard is not that you're yelling at them, it's that they don't want to disappoint the people next to them because they know they're working hard. And that the shared team, we continue to make the individual better as an organization. So in theory, any one of my analysts or portfolio managers could go run a portfolio at a pod or at some other, you know, start his own firm. But, you know, I like to think that our team makes them better. I make them better. They make me better. And that kind of mentality and the culture, I think, is a little bit unique and I think is important to building something enduring and particularly in a business that's got so much volatility in capital and markets and in temperament and people those are some of the things, and I do think they're quite different skill sets, as you point out, and people who view themselves as good investors and start businesses maybe often don't appreciate that. I'm not sure I appreciated that when I did it when I was young, and I got the benefit of learning on the job.
Mm.
Speaking of your team, so I believe you have a team of over 20 analysts now, and as you said, many of them could go and run their own money. But I guess it would be a real, you know, I'm just trying to imagine how I would do it. It would be really difficult to teach a full team to invest and, you know, all that knowledge that you've built up through, you know, being in markets year after year, imparting that to younger analysts. I guess, how have you done it? What have you learned from doing it? And any tips for Bryce and I as we try and learn to be better investors as well?
Well, I think... a couple things I would say. One is the team is a little bit unusual in its size based on how we're broken up. So we have 15 or 16 analysts and portfolio managers that most people would consider sector-based analysts and PMs. We have an additional three that are just short only because the short side requires a lot more resources. Your position sizes are small, that they turn over more often. So you need more ideas, more horsepower on the short side. And then we have a team of about seven or eight quant and data science people that are resources for me and the investment team. So it's a big team, but it's a little more manageable when you think about it in that sense. And I would say I like to hire. We've historically hired younger analysts that maybe had 2 years of investment banking experience, maybe 2 years in private equity or something else, but not a lot of investing experience. I wanted them to have building blocks, but then we teach them how to invest our way, and they bring something different to the table. And ultimately, through growing several people that way as a team underneath me, and they kind of are training and working the analysts below them. You're kind of I don't train a lot of the young analysts that we have now, or any of them, to be honest, but they hear me speak in all of our sector meetings, in our research meetings, and they're kind of getting the detail from the portfolio manager, sector head that they work for. So a little bit of trickle down. I think what I would say is, I think that this business is more about the competitive spirit of figuring it out than being the smartest person in the room. You have to be smart enough, but that's not the highest bar in the world. And you have to be hungry and humble and always learning. So there's a type of person that I think is the kind of person we want to hire. And then maybe another thing that I think we do a little bit differently than others is, I'm a believer in working with and trying to lift up my underperformers rather than cutting them loose and moving on. If I think somebody has the capabilities and the right attitude, I'd much rather work on their weaknesses and make them better than get rid of them, spend the next 6 months finding the right person, another 6 months training them, another 6 months trusting them. And it's a lot of time, and I think people don't appreciate that as often. We're in a performance-oriented business, so it's easy to say, like, you're underperforming, you're out. We will more often take, for the right person with the right attitude and capabilities, we'll take the invest in them approach.
Mm. Now, it's great to hear how you're unpacking it, because Alec and I are obviously growing a team ourselves, and it's just great to hear from other people who are building teams on their own as well. Now, Ricky, before we jump into some of your top holdings, because we love to hear what our experts are investing in, we will take a quick break. But firstly, the exciting news for our Equity Mates community is that if you're unable to get down to the Sohn Hearts and Minds conference in person, there is a virtual conference available for some of the selected sessions. Now, we've been able to twist the arm of the organizers of Sohn Hearts and Minds, and we have a discount code for the EM community. It gives you 20% off the virtual ticket, bringing it to $400 a ticket, a large portion of which goes to a tax-deductible donation to Australian Medical Research, as we said at the top. Tickets can be purchased on their website. We'll put a link in the show notes. Use the code EQUITYMATES2022, no space, and you'll get the chance to listen to some of the amazing speakers, of which Ricky is one, from the Sohn Hearts and Minds Conference. Amazing initiative. So, Ricky, let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsors.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
All right, Ricky, we grabbed the latest 13F for Eminence and pulled out some of your top holdings, and really keen to dig into some of them. So Ashland Global is the top holding according to the 13F. Talk us through it. What is Ashland Holding? What's the thesis? And perhaps what's the bear case as well?
So Ashland Holdings is a specialty chemical / additives company. They make very fine chemical compounds that go into consumer products, into life sciences, and into coatings. So think about some chemical that would give shampoo its thickness or its smell or something that would give food or a another consumer product its properties, life science stuff that goes into pharma. So they will make some products that go like into coatings or extended release. So they're not making the pharma product, but they're making a property that makes the product better. It is and can be a fundamentally really good business because you're providing critical value to these products in terms of features and functionality that their customers want. It's a relatively low cost of the end product, so you tend to have reasonable pricing power. And you work with your customers to get designed into R&D, where they're developing the next toothpaste, and you're there with chemical compounds that help them make that toothpaste what it is, and or the coating, so the thickness of a paint, and so there's a whole bunch of things, but that's the business. Ashland was a holding company for a really long time, and over a number of years leading up to our investment, had divested. So they were in. They owned Valvoline. They owned a refining operation, and they were a big holding company. And they had done a lot of what I would say is the right capital allocation. Let's sell off a lot of business and get down to a good business. And when we came to the situation, they had gotten down to kind of having sold the composites business, which was the last what I'd say was less good business, and we're running this additives business, but had structured the company as a holding company. And so they had never had operational execution excellence. And so they were underperforming. So it was a good asset or a good industry or good potential, but the numbers, the growth rate, the margins were well below what we observed from a lot of other companies. And one of the things that we learned through studying this industry is it's a business that can be a good business. It doesn't have to be a good business. You have to be close to your customers' R&D. You have to tie your R&D to theirs. You have to have great customer service. You got to do a lot of things from an execution standpoint. The old management team wasn't doing that. And so we invested behind a new CEO, Guillermo Novo, who's coming in and basically taking a good business that was run in a holding company structure poorly and running it significantly better. And that was the thesis. It continues to be the thesis. He has made, you know, we are midway through. So not only has he made significant operating improvements and run the business better and accelerating growth and lowering costs, he has shed their last more cyclical adhesives business. And he is doing tuck-in M&A that allows them to get new capabilities for their market presence for their kind of key chemical chains. And what I would say is some of the benefits of what he's doing are really yet to sort of play out. So when you restart the growth engine of a business like this, you're a couple of years in development. You think about the length of time for a pharma product or a consumer product. And so the new product introductions are just beginning to kick in. Growth is just accelerating. Margins have improved, but have a ways to go. And it's a very underlevered balance sheet that they have started to do the right things from capital allocation. So I'd say this is a classic pretty good to great company. And it was mispriced because it was priced as an underperforming company. And we saw the catalyst for it to become a leading performer. And I think we're midway through that transition.
Love that.
It's fascinating. That's the thing I love about investing, Ricky. Yeah. And I guess the privilege that Bryce and I have getting to speak to people like you, we just find out about companies that we would otherwise never know about. Ashland Global. Let's talk about the Hearts and Minds Conference a little bit in general, because you know, it's something that we think it's great. But you know, you're coming in over from America to participate. That's it's a big trip. Why is participating important to you?
So I think couple things. I'm a big believer in charity and giving back as a core value for those of us that have been incredibly fortunate. And there are a number of conferences here, Invest for Kids in Chicago, SONE in New York, where I've done similar things, and I've seen the incredible things that are done, the incredible amount of money, and the way a community comes together to both, kind of share kind of business insights, but also raise money for really important charities. And so when I came over to Australia recently, and I come over for another reason, my son's in school in Sydney for the semester, I was coming over and scheduling some business meetings, some potential investors, some people who know the market. I had never spent much time there. I was kind of blown away, to be honest, with the community, the size of the investment world over there, and the people involved in the SONE conference I had met with and were really taken away by the $40 million in a short time that they've raised. Very impressive. And so I think if I can come and I'm a new speaker, I'm someone that people haven't heard from and can help them build an interesting conference, I think that's an amazing thing. And I think the Australian market and the investor base in Australia is one that has never really had access to us or we've really looked for. I mean, technically they have access, but we haven't really come and got to know them. And so my plan over the next, year or two is to do a few more trips. And this seemed like a great way to get known and do something that was, meaningful charitably with great people. So I'm really excited.
Yeah, awesome. You'll have to come and check out Equity Mates HQ when you get here. Open invite.
Great.
Ricky, the experts that SONE Hearts and Minds get are, have great track records, certainly experts in their field and investing with sort of time horizons of 5 years plus. So we're always interested to understand when you come and pitch and the stock that you're pitching sort of has a time frame of 12 months that it needs to perform. How do you actually think about that? And what are you looking for in the next 12 months that's going to be the catalyst for a growth?
One of the things that I would say from our standpoint is we always take a long-term view, But I like to say you plant seeds at different times and they sprout up at different times. And somehow, we've had a portfolio that hasn't had at least on the long side, a major year of underperformance with the exception of 2010. So I don't think you always have to try to make money in the short term to make money consistently in the short term. There's a little bit of a difference, and this is one of my differences with other people. People are looking for near-term catalysts. Everybody's trying to make money now. People want to be in with a winner. They want to make money this month, this quarter. One of our competitive advantages look over that. But somehow, because I don't buy every stock today and have to wait 2 years for it to work out, some I bought a year ago, and they're going to work this year. Some I bought this year, and they'll work quickly. Some I bought 2 or 3 years ago and the thesis got delayed, but I still believed in it. And some I got wrong. So just kind of holistically. So I think that if I look at the market today, what I've said is I think there are interesting ideas in every category. So I think the market has come to hate unprofitable companies, unprofitable tech, unprofitable growth. And for good reason. We had a lot of unprofitable companies with some crazy valuations that never made any sense that we didn't own. But they will throw the baby out with the bathwater. And we have written about Uber in our letter recently as an example where the market has priced it like an unprofitable tech company. And we think it is just moving into profitability structurally. And that is the opportunity. So the market is mistreating a lot of companies like not a lot. It is treating them all one way. I like to say that since November, all the unprofitable tech companies are down 70%. Some should be down 90, and we're short some of those. And some should have only been down 30 or 20 and have really good upside. And so that's one. I think the market is very worried about cyclicality now. The economy is slowing. That's obvious. And one of the things that we like to look at, it can be idiosyncratic names where there's something that will make this company on a micro basis stand out, but everyone's selling it for a big picture reason. So there are some other companies that I could think about pitching where I would call them a dirt cheap cyclical with a micro story that will significantly overwhelm the cyclical, which is largely priced in anyway. So everyone's worried about, you know, X, and you know, there's a range of things that happen, but if X happens, it's priced for that, and the idiosyncratic factor will drive outperformance. And sometimes people overprice kind of what's obvious and in front of them, so that's kind of my view. And we own some quality compounders that I like too. Ashland would be more of a quality compounder that's mispriced for a different reason. What I would say to you is the market gives you different opportunities at different times based on how it is reacting to the world or what's sort of working. And you know, COVID was a time like that where, you know, up until the election of the vaccine in 2020, everything that was a COVID loser or a value stock was shunned for the shiny growth. And there was a lot of opportunity in that kind of tacking against what the market was, I would say, like the flavor of the day. And this is where being a little bit contrarian helps us.
Yeah, well, Ricky, you've got me very excited to hear your pitch on the 18th of November. I'm looking forward to hearing what you do decide. Look, we are almost out of time, and we do like to finish with the same final three questions. But before then, I want to ask you a general one about, I guess, the market as it stands in late October 2022. You know, inflation's still high, interest rates are rising, everyone's watching the Fed. How do you think about that sort of macro picture, where we are in the economy, and I guess, or I guess, do you think about it at all?
Yeah, we have to. It's interesting. You know, 15 or 20 years ago, I think we focused on individual stocks, and over the cycles and the GFC, and you know, we've had to become more macro aware, and now we have to become factor aware because of how the market has changed quite a lot in the 15 years. And this is something I will actually talk about at the Sohn Conference as well, a little bit of big picture, how the market has, the structure has changed, who the players are, how they trade, how they think, and how securities get priced. I think that what I would say is, I think the market has it about right with the risks and the issues. I think we are choppy to the sideways. You want to fade the extremes. So we had been, you know, buying as of, you know, a week or two ago, and we had been selling and reducing some exposure after this kind of big several day rally that we've seen. And I think after the kind of 20 to 25% decline, there is more balance in the market. And I would say that I think there's a little more downside skew than upside skew because reflexivity plays through, and the markets and the economy are going one direction. And so there's a little bit of second order effects that will have to play out. But I think that people can, with all the negativity, and we have been cautious this year, I think people can forget a few things. Like underneath the surface, a lot of stocks are down a lot and have priced in lower earnings and higher rates in a lot of places. Number two, institutional investors are broadly positioned very negatively. Sentiment is awful. Other than the retail investor, who is still in the market, and that's a factor on the other side, a lot of strategists are espousing negative views, so there's a lot of negativity. Equities are nominal earnings vehicles. So we may go through a recession, but a lot of the recession models people have are recession in a low interest rate, low inflation world, where their earnings expectations may be worse than I think they'll be as companies are able to price for inflation. And there may be real earnings declines, but nominally they may grow. And we invest in a nominal world. So, and then lastly, the U.S. private sector is pretty healthy. Consumer balance sheets, good. Bank balance sheets, great. Corporate balance sheets, decent. People are well prepared for this. So I think we got to see a few more cards play out, but I think for the next year, choppy, sideways, fade the extremes, buy individual, a little more dispersion and individual companies. And we'll have to see how sticky inflation is and what the Fed's reaction function. There are things we can't know. And to sit here and tell you, like, I know exactly how inflation is going to play out and then what the Fed's reaction function is going to be, I could give you a convicted opinion. But, you know, I think anybody that tells you they know the answers to that would be only partly true. And there's a lot of research we can do, but actually predicting future inflation is one of the hardest things for anyone to do.
Yeah. Well, Ricky, we have run out of time, but the great news for our audience, if they do want to hear more from you, they can, if they can make it down to Tasmania on the 18th of November, they can see you in person, or they can jump online and they use the code EquityMates2022. They can buy an online ticket with a 20% discount. How good. But Ricky, let's jump into the final three questions. And the first one is, do you have any books that you consider must read?
I have a few books that I think are important to read. Good to Great by Jim Collins is a terrific kind of business strategy. I think The Art of Short Selling by Catherine Staley. Recently, Titans was a book about the industrial companies. I believe Titans is the name that I thought was an excellent, excellent book. I actually quite like more than books. I quite like interviews and writings of different investors as well. So all the Buffett letters, and I would encourage a lot of people to read and listen to people. You can't be like any one person, but you can pick little bits of things from people that resonate with you and build your own investing compass. And I think that's maybe the most important part of being an investor, because you got to have a conviction in what you do. And therefore, I don't want to be just like Warren Buffett. I don't want to be just like Stevie Cohen or David Tepper. But there are pieces of each one of them that I like. And build your own compass is my kind of view.
I love that. The book, The Lessons from the Titans. I actually, it's funny you say that. I actually bought that. I haven't read it yet, but I bought it this week. So great minds think alike, I guess, Ricky.
it's very instructive in recent book. Yeah.
The second question. Forget valuation, forget investing in it today. We just love to understand what you think makes a company great. So based on, you know, what the company does and who runs it, what's the best company you've ever come across?
It's probably either Marriott or Google. A little bit different businesses. I think, you know, people probably really know Google, but let me just touch on Marriott for a second. I've covered this company for my entire kind of career. I mentioned earlier that I did some lodging back in the early 90s. So, you know, the franchising business is one of the great businesses. You get to grow with other people's capital. You get kind of nominal pricing. You get super high returns, and you bring a lot of advantages to the ecosystem through the franchising business. And that company has not only has those great business characteristics, but the Marriott's as a management team and the people that they've brought on, early on they separated out Host Marriott, the real estate from the brands, and that was a brilliant, you know, very early prescient kind of strategy, and so they've done the right things on capital allocation and execution and keeping the quality of the brands great. So to your point, it was start with a good business, have good management that executes well and does good gap capital allocation. So that'd be one. And I think it'd be hard to sort of knock Google, although maybe after last night's earnings, people are saying they're undisciplined in their expenses. And I think they have been terrific in all those areas in capital allocation and execution. And they started with a fundamentally great business that builds as the ecosystem gets bigger, they build their competitive advantages, and these sort of flywheels are kind of important. Yeah.
Two great businesses. We've had people answer Google before, but you're the first to answer Marriott, and that's why we love this question, because we always hear new perspectives on it. But Ricky, final question: if you think back to your younger self, buying was it Felcor Lodging for you know, your paper portfolio early days? What advice would you give to your younger self?
I would tell my younger self to nurture his network better. at a very young age, I was given access to incredible CEOs, CFOs, and you know, I asked good questions, and I was thoughtful, and I built a nice rapport, and it probably took me till much later in life to realize that you know, we don't get anywhere by ourselves, and we learn a lot from other people and drawing on other people's expertise and experiences. And I think, you know, doing that in a thoughtful way would have been a really helpful thing. So that would be one. And I think this notion, so this notion of, you know, learning from your mistakes, but not necessarily in the immediate aftermath or in singularity. And what I mean by that is a lot of people can lose money and say, let's not just do that again. Now, A, right after you've lost the money, your perspective, maybe the mistake you made was actually selling the stock there. And what is the lesson? And then I like to string together. So I think I was like everybody else, like you draw these one-offs, but you string together the mistakes that you made. What are my tendencies? What things? So I think in the mistake category, I would take a little bit of time and build some perspective. So that would be another one. And then I think the one that everyone always says is the hard decisions, whether they're people-based or otherwise, that you agonize over, they almost always feel great right afterwards, and you agonize, make them, when you make a decision, move swiftly.
Yeah. Three great pieces of advice to finish on there, Ricky. And thank you so much for taking the time today to speak with us in the Equity Mates community. We're super excited to see you at Sewn Hearts and Minds, such a great cause. And, you know, thank you for saying great things about Australia. Hopefully we can meet in person when you get here.
This has been great. Appreciate the thoughtful questions and the good dialogue.
No worries. Well, good luck with the pitch, and we look forward to catching up and speaking again soon. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.
You have been listening to an Equity Mates Media production. In the spirit of reconciliation, Equity Mates Media acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. This podcast is intended for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general advice only and has not taken into account your personal financial circumstances, needs, or objectives. Before acting on general advice, you should consider if it is relevant to your needs and read the relevant product disclosure statement. And if you're unsure, please speak to a financial professional. The hosts of this podcast and their guests may have positions in the companies mentioned. Equity Mates Media operates under an Australian Financial Services Licence 540697.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.